Welcome to Beyond Borders, the world's first talk show made especially for English learners and global citizens, with me, your host, Ethan. In every episode of this show, it is my job to guide you outside of the classroom and into the real world with life-changing insights from some of the world's best teachers, language learners, innovators, and leaders, all here to help you unleash your highest potential in your English and your life. So, if you are ready to join our movement of millions and together create a world beyond borders, then let's get started with the show. So my guest today is Vanessa from Speak English with Vanessa. And if you don't know her, she is an American English teacher who has 3 million subscribers on her Speak English with Vanessa channel on YouTube. On her channel, she makes English learning fun with weekly lessons where she helps you to speak English naturally, confidently, and fluently. Vanessa has lived in France, where she was a nanny, and she taught English to the 2 children of the family she lived with, who, when she arrived, didn't speak English at all. And she didn't always teach English as a second language. She actually started teaching as a normal teacher in a typical American school. But then she moved with her husband to South Korea, where she became an English teacher. Now, after coming back, she was looking to continue teaching, and a mentor helped her to discover how to start teaching English online. She now works full-time creating content and videos on YouTube and her subscription course, The Fearless Fluency Club. In this debut episode of the show, you are going to learn a ton and get a lot of inspiration. So first off, you'll learn why Vanessa deleted all of the social media apps off of her phone. We'll see how her perspective changed moving abroad and how she prevents losing her French skills while now living in the United States, despite a very busy schedule with her business and as a mom. Her opinions and strategies on raising her 2 children, how resourcefulness, passion, and small wins have made her successful. Her opinions on whether you need to speak English with a native. Also, Vanessa reads a lot, so you will learn the books that she recommends most to English learners, and so much more. And if you stick around until the end, we play a game which you'll have a lot of fun learning with. So, without any further ado, let's get into episode 1 of Beyond Borders. So Vanessa, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm so glad to be here.
I'm really excited about this. I'm so glad that we get to collaborate on something again.
Yeah, I feel like it's been a long time, but on YouTube, you're a familiar face, so it's nice to talk to you in person.
Likewise. So my first question for you, it's actually something that I found really fascinating through our research. So you're going to have to tell me whether or not this is true. So I heard that you actually learned to fly before you learned to drive. Is that right?
Oh, that's true. Well, learn to fly might be a little strong. I took some flying lessons before I ever sat behind the wheel of a car. And that used to be my passion to learn how to fly, to become a pilot. My bedroom as a teenager was covered in airplane posters, and I think I didn't really have the deep knowledge of the technological side of flying, but I at least had the superficial passion about it and went to go take lessons at the local airport and bartered. That was kind of my first job. I would wash the airplanes and do some odd jobs in the hangar where they keep the airplanes. And then in the afternoons, the pilot, she would take me up for some lessons. And it was very informal, but I think as a teenager, it was like the perfect kick to get me excited about something that I was already passionate about.
It sounds like from a pretty young age, you were very resourceful. I mean, actually, like, in order to get those flying lessons, I know those are very expensive usually. So actually like washing the planes and stuff, figuring out like a way to kind of feed that passion, it's very impressive.
Yeah, you got to find a way to make it happen. And sometimes things just come up. You find someone who knows someone who knows someone, and you just kind of take that opportunity. So yeah, it was really nice that she was willing to do that. But I guess you're right. I did find that.
And do you think that that at all was like linked to kind of later having a passion or an interest in traveling, like just the whole concept of flying, of taking yourself to a new place? of seeing the world from up above.
I think that's kind of what was underlined there. And nowadays, I think maybe when my kids get older, I would love to be able to get my small pilot, small plane license. I think that would be really cool to do, but not necessarily as a career nowadays. But I did find that once I started to travel and go abroad, my passion specifically for airplanes became less. And then the idea that translated was to fly, to go, to kind of have this limitless experience traveling the world. So I think that that maybe was the root of it. But I think both of those things were pretty linked together, because if you've ever traveled, you know, travel is very exciting, maybe addictive. And yeah, you can be really passionate about it.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing that, that passion was able to kind of like translate into that. So I'm going to kind of pivot now to something different that you actually told me about. So you told me that before our talk that digital minimalism is something that's really important to you. So can you tell the audience what exactly is that and why do you find it so interesting?
Yeah. So digital minimalism is the title of a book. And mm-hmm. I feel like personally, I have a very turbulent relationship with social media based on my job, which is to post things to YouTube or to share things via social media. And I know the benefit of that educationally, but the flip side of that is that the internet or social media can really be addictive. It can be something that can take us away from the real happinesses in life that we are looking at our phones instead of, you know, looking at our friends or looking at the trees around us. And when I found this book, it just kind of really clearly spelled out that this is the purpose of social media. The purpose of social media is to get your attention. So we shouldn't feel guilty about looking at social media. That's what it's there for. That's the purpose. And we are fulfilling that purpose, but also to be more intentional about our usage. So while I was reading this book, one of the things that really stuck out to me was that with the rise of social media use, also there has been a pretty strong correlation with the rise of anxiety, and that a lot of psychologists and therapists have found that when their clients use social media less, they become less anxious. And there might be other things going on in those situations, but that's at least a trigger for a lot of anxiety, that kind of fast-pacedness, always looking for a notification, comparing ourselves to others. And when I saw that, it just really kind of put a stamp down and said, I don't need this in my personal life. So I deleted all kinds of social media apps from my phone. I do need to use social media occasionally for my job. So to help myself with that, I have an app on my phone called App Blocker or App Block. And it gives you a specific time. You can choose like 1 hour per week or whatever you want to be able to open those apps on your phone if you have to use them on the phone. But I just found that something like that was very freeing to me. And I feel like whenever this type of topic comes up in conversation, I get quite excited. Like, yeah, you don't need Instagram. Just delete Instagram. Look at it once a week. That's all you need. Just 1 hour. Find out what your friends are doing. That's it. Give them a call instead. And that kind of passion that I really recommend checking out that book. I don't work for him or anything, but it was very informative. And I think kind of spoke very well to the things that I was already feeling about the internet. So if that's something that any of you out there struggle with or are concerned about, then yeah, take a look at the internet usage, social media, phone usage in your life, and yeah, see if that might be something that can be worked out.
Definitely. I think that's a really hot topic right now. Like in the last year, that documentary, The Social Dilemma, came out. I know a lot of people were talking about that. I saw that myself, and I've very similar to you, I think just kind of like a natural conclusion I came to was there were other places that I wanted to spend my time that were outside of Facebook, I think was like the biggest one. And I knew that, you know, that could instead be put towards like learning a language or, you know, music or like other things that I think add more to my life than seeing someone's vacation pictures and like feeling jealous or feeling depressed because maybe your life feels less interesting, even though obviously you're just kind of seeing other people's lives within a bubble when you see that. So I think that's something that's really important for people to kind of be reflective of and kind of see what role do they want that to play in their life, and is it actually like adding to your life or is it taking away, kind of like you're saying, like adding anxiety or something like that. So, and how would you say, because obviously you are someone who is having to use this in your business and everything, you're kind of in a sense a digital marketer. So how would you say, kind of as a creator, do you use this in a responsible way?
I think that it's really important for me to be honest with myself. And before I watched or read this book, actually, I read this book maybe a month before that documentary came out. And I felt so passionate about this book. Like, I need to tell everyone. And then the documentary came out and I thought, oh, it did my work for me. This is great. But I feel like being honest with myself that I'm not, before I felt like, oh, I'm going to look at Facebook and check my my students' Facebook group. I'm going to check my page, see how the comments are going. But really, I would spend most of my time just scrolling and seeing things that were kind of mindless or the same with other social media. I had the thought, oh, I'm going to do this for work. But really what ended up happening was that was a small portion of it. And instead, I ended up not doing other profitable things. I don't think you always need to be doing something profitable, but it wasn't something beneficial, I think. It wasn't even good entertainment for me. So I feel like being very intentional about how much time when I do this. I always do it on my desktop computer, so I have to be in here. I'm not playing in the yard with my kids and I see a notification. That's not possible because it's not on my phone, but I have to be in the office. And I think that when you're in that type of setting, it's much easier to be conscious about how much time you're spending and what you're doing instead of on your phone. I think the phone is kind of the crux of the issue because it's always with us and it's very easy to just slip onto it and take a look and take us out of that current moment that we're in real life. Hope I didn't go on about that too long, but I feel quite excited about that as a prospect, that you can kind of free your mind and you can step away to some extent.
Yeah, I think if people take one takeaway from this podcast is that if you turn off your notifications, it's just like your life becomes so much better. You're able to, like, I always find it's a little bit of like a downer or, you know, a little bit depressing when I go walk around and it's like here we have a lot of terraces and stuff and it's just you see four people sitting around a table eating a meal together, but they're all on their phone, like staring at it and stuff. So it's kind of like taking that power away from your phone so that it's not distracting, so you can be present in the moment. You can be with the people that you're actually with and actually be creating memories, you know, not spending your time with people who aren't even there in the room.
Yeah. I think there is also a learning curve, if I can use that fun expression, of when you stop looking at your phone as much as you are, however much you are, you realize how many moments there are that you were looking at your phone, how many blank moments there are in your life. Like, oh, I feel like antsy right now. I feel like I need to be looking at something, or I feel like this moment wouldn't have existed before because I would have just looked at my phone. But when you have those moments, it kind of is a little bit of a shock. Like, oh, maybe I do look at my phone too much, even if you think you don't. That's what I thought. But it can be really beautiful to kind of reconnect with the people around you and with yourself, just having thoughts, being alone with your thoughts while you go for a walk instead of always listening to something. I mean, you should always listen to this podcast, but apart from that, it's nice to, have some alone time and just be with yourself and be with the people that you're around.
Couldn't agree more. So coming back to what we were talking about before about like world travel and everything, for people that know you, they probably already are aware that you lived in France, that you taught English to some kids, you lived with a family and everything, right? And that you also taught English in South Korea. So I'm really curious, how do you think that your perspective of the world changed from those experiences? And could maybe talk about the first time that you moved to France, if you had like any aha moments. I know for me, me, my first experience abroad was in Germany. I remember like clearly having this moment where I was sitting around in the classroom with like my schoolmates there and thinking like, in this moment, like the same conversation I'm having here in German in like a village in Germany could be happening exactly the same like with my friends in the States. And I kind of had like this realization that, you know, German kids aren't any different than Americans are when it really comes down to it. We're all human beings. So I'm curious, like, what kind of realizations or perspective shifts you had?
Yeah, I think that is very true, that the more you get to know people around the world, the more you realize we're all human. We all have so many things in common, even though there's a lot of big things that can be different. I can go back to that experience in France as a nanny, but I noticed that a lot when I lived in Korea, because I had this impression that Asia, Eastern culture is so different from where I've come from. This is just going to be shocking. We're going to land, get off the plane and be completely shocked. And I think that when it comes to culture, sometimes visually, yes, there's a lot of difference when you visit a place. But for us, my husband and I, we both went to Korea to be teachers. Initially, there wasn't an awful lot of shock. Maybe that's part of our personality to not be too shocked. But also, I think digging deeper into people's your motivations. Why do you do what you do? What are the dreams or the allowable dreams in that culture to the future? I think those are the types of things that can seem different, and yet we are all motivated by similar things like family and status or fears, similar fears in life. So those things that I thought would be quite different, yeah, really are somewhat similar. But in Korea, we lived in an apartment and taught at a school with children. But in France, I lived with a French family. They had an apartment and they had a little upper floor of the apartment and I lived above them, but it was connected. It was really cool. Actually, you opened a closet and there was a little staircase in the closet behind the coats and that went to my room. It was so cool. A, like little movie moment to get to go inside the closet and go up to my room.
And like your own secret passageway.
Yes. They'll never find me. They think it's just coats. Yeah, but that experience, I think the first time that I met the children was kind of shocking to me because I'd never really met, especially kids. I feel like all the kids I know in my life up to that point were English speakers, and it's very easy to connect with them and to communicate. But the first time I met them, I remember the family, the kids were in the south of France. The family lived in Paris, and the kids were on vacation with their grandparents in the south of France. And so the parents took me in Paris to the south of France to spend like the week to meet their family and just to kind of be part of their vacation, which is very lucky. But I also got to meet the kids there. And I remember we were at one of their family members' swimming pools in their backyard, and they were splashing around in the pool. And I walked up and their mom said in French, and at this point my French was nothing. I could say I'm an American. There was French going on around me for the previous couple days. I had no idea what was happening. And she, I guess, introduced me. And then they said something to me, but I had no idea what they said. And I told them in English because it was my job to speak in English to them. And then the family would speak in French with me in daily life. But my relationship with the kids was supposed to be in English, kind of just forcefully immersing them in English. I remember the first thing I said was something like, "Oh, do you want to throw the ball in the pool? Some little game we could play together." And the look on their face, there was a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old. They looked at their mom and just said, "Mom, what did you do to us? Who is this? Why? I can't understand her." They were so shocked because they had never met someone who didn't speak French. And I think it was this mutual moment where I thought, oh no, what have I gotten myself into that I need to care for them and connect with them? I think that was the most difficult thing at the beginning, is to create that kind of bond together. But because they're kids, you know, you can play together. And once they realize you're a nice person, you can just like throw a ball together and do some little things that don't involve much words. But that type of experience was definitely quite surprising and mind-opening, that, yeah, people do speak other languages. People do connect. Maybe if people live in Europe, that's already something that's part of their mindset. But in the U.S., we don't often see people who speak a lot of other languages. You hear Spanish speakers, but it's not quite your daily life, at least the life that I was living in the U.S. So that was that was quite a big shock. A little bit of a learning curve for me to figure out what to do, but I got very lucky. That family was so, so kind to me. And yeah, that makes a big difference when you're living there and working for them.
That makes a lot of sense. So you kind of like arrived there, you had this feeling of like shock, overwhelm of, you know, where am I? What did I get myself into? These kids aren't going to like me and stuff. Did you have like any tricks or any things that you started doing that helped you, for one, kind of just with that sort of probably anxiety that you felt in that moment, and also to start developing that relationship with the kids and to get them to start opening up to speaking to you in English?
Yeah. As far as them speaking in English with me, there were a couple key moments that happened pretty regularly throughout the week, sometimes daily, like after I picked them up from their school. We would go and buy a baguette every day and take it home to the family. And when we were walking home from the bakery, they always wanted to break off the end of the bread and share it. That was like something that maybe everybody does that, but they were really excited about that. So I tried to teach them just a little phrase that they could say and kind of integrate that into that moment so that always at that moment they could say, "Please, Vanessa, can I have a piece of bread?" And something very simple that they felt like they could remember and repeat, and there was an immediate reward, that piece of bread. But yeah, I think that them speaking was probably the most challenging because they knew after a while that I could understand them. So once my French level grew, I was speaking in English with them, but they were still speaking in French back to me. And because they knew that I could understand, there wasn't that pressure for them to speak in English. I have some other, it's called an au pair, but like a nanny, nanny friends at that time who didn't speak any French, and their children who they watched spoke English much faster because they couldn't speak in French to their nanny. They had to speak in English. They had to kind of push themselves to learn a bit more. But it was still amazing how much they could understand after a year of being together. So yeah, I think kind of empowering them to say a couple phrases that really helped our connection. And I took some French classes at the time. Each morning for a couple hours, I had a French class. And I think what really helped me to bond with them, and especially with the family, the parents, because my boss was the mom of the family. She told me everything that I needed to know, and I was really connected with her. I asked my teacher to just help me with some key phrases that, for example, one I remember was, "I should have something." So one time she wrote a note and they didn't really speak much English, which was lucky for me. Maybe not always lucky for them because there was lots of misunderstandings. But there was one situation where she asked me, when the laundry machine beeps, can you take out the laundry and hang it up? Usually that wasn't part of my job description, so it was kind of an extra thing she was just asking me to do as a favor. But she wrote that in French, and I thought that she wrote, "Can you just turn off the washer?" So for 3 days straight, whenever the washer beeped, I just turned it off, and the wet laundry was sitting in there. And when she came after a couple of days, she said, "Vanessa, did you not see my note? Why didn't you hang up the laundry?" She was really nice about it. And I said, "Oh, I did. I turned it off." And I think it's because the word to hang up and to turn off were quite similar. And I just missed it. And so in that situation, it was so helpful. I'd asked my teacher, "How can I say I should have looked up that word?" Because she wrote it in a note. Or I should have something. Just that phrase kind of made me feel empowered to be able to be polite, kind of express some regret. But I had no idea what those verbs were in French, how to put that phrase together. And once I could say that, I felt like, oh, I can really express what I want to say to her instead of work all around the point. I wanted to be able to, yeah, say that as politely but directly as possible in those missed communication situations. So yeah, I think some specific phrases helped both of us.
I think like with both those things, with the kids and with like your own experience, you're talking about like small wins, right? Which I have found always is like really, when I was teaching individual students and stuff, I always found that really important to, you know, in every class that they want to like feel like they've had a few small wins, because I think that that's really what's going to motivate you to keep going, is if just constantly you can be giving yourself small wins. So I think it's always really important to be looking for what those are, and whether that's, you know, using a new word for the first time or kind of being able to introduce some connected speech into your speaking, like instead of saying what to you, saying what you or something like that, so that you can just have like these little things that every day you're feeling that progress a little bit to keep motivating you forward.
Yeah, that seems really essential. I guess humans, we need that little daily wins,
definitely,
small wins.
So you learned French there, right? And I'm really curious because I'm sure a lot of people who are listening, like you, have kids and everything, and they probably struggle to find the time, you know, in that kind of chaotic environment of trying to raise children and have that time with your family. And then also being an entrepreneur and having your own business, are you able to make time for that? And do you have any tips for other parents out there?
It's a lot. I think that finding a specific time every week has been something that's helpful for me. So yes, I did have that year living with a French family, but even before that, having once a week, there was a French meetup in my city. And even though I understood nothing, I just wanted to kind of surround myself with some other people who are speaking French, hope that they never asked me anything because I never understood them. But just having that specific time. And even now, every Monday around 3 o'clock, I have a Skype conversation for 30 minutes with a French teacher. We just talk about whatever's going on in life, and just having that specific time that even if I completely forget anything about French during the week because life is crazy, I know that I have that time. And I think after living in Korea, when I was in Korea, I was more focused on living life there, learning some Korean if I could, the job there, figuring out that I didn't really do anything with French for almost 2 or 3 years. And then coming back, realizing, oh, I have forgotten some, I have kind of lost this. And it's something that makes me excited to do. Like, I love to speak in French. Something about that, maybe for English learners too, you feel that no matter what you're saying or talking about, you just get excited. Like, oh, I can communicate in this way. A different part of my brain gets activated and I just feel really excited. So I wanted to get back into that, even though it was a little more slow going at the beginning, kind of dusting some dust off in my brain from French words. But having that specific time is really helpful. Everyone knows this is the time when mom is going to go and speak with her French teacher and kind of can organize the week a bit in that way. So that's been really helpful for me.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's like you have that commitment every week that at the very least you know you're going to be getting an hour of speaking practice in.
Yeah, that's really nice. And it's nice to be able to connect with someone else. I know there's a lot of benefit of like watching a video in English or in French and listening to a podcast, but also using what you're learning can help you to stay motivated. If you learn something useful, I hope during this podcast, you can be able to take some expression and use that with someone else, or even write a note or write a text message using it, something that's making it more practical. I think that can be really motivating.
Definitely. I couldn't agree more. And you mentioned something before I just wanted to come back to, that when you were first learning French, you went to like these meetups and you said like you didn't want anyone to speak to you just because like you were scared that you wouldn't understand, you wouldn't know how to reply. Did you have anything that kind of like helped you to gain some confidence in your listening and your speaking?
Yeah. I think first of all, other people's kindness was really great. When I told them, yeah, I'm going to be living in France for a year. This was the summer before I went, and they were so excited for me. They gave me, usually they told me in English because they knew when they started to speak in French, my eyes just went... But just any kind of kindness that they gave me kind of helped to boost my confidence. But I'm trying to just put yourself out there. There was one guy at the meetup who was living in the U.S. for a couple months for work, and he was from France, and we just seemed to connect and like understand each other. Not in French, but in English. But our personalities, we got each other. So we got together a couple times and he was telling me about where he was in France. And he did some work in Paris, kind of giving me some heads ups about what life is like in Paris or different cool things. And when we spoke together in the US before I lived there, we spoke completely in English. And then when I was in Paris, we met up one time. The first time it was at the beginning of my time there. And we spoke like 30-70, 30% French, 70% English. And then the next time we met up, it was at the end of my time there, and we spoke the whole day in French. And at the end of that day, I was on the biggest language high. I can't believe it. This is like the embodiment of language progress, that you can't understand anything. You're speaking completely in your mother language. And then going from a little uncomfortable to being able to actually continue that friendship in the language that you want to speak. So for me, that was French. That felt so like that win we're talking about. That felt really great and helped me to feel like what I was doing was worth it. So it's not always easy.
Yeah, I totally know how you feel. So kind of coming back to, you know, the fact that, you know, you're a mom and everything, you were telling me that you didn't used to want to have kids, which I think normally is surprising, especially if you meet someone who has two kids. So can you tell our audience what changed your mind?
Yeah. So I think, I'm sure a psychologist could dig deep down into that, that fear. But I think that until I was teaching in Korea, I felt very hesitant about having children. I think that the mothers that I had seen that were my age weren't me. They weren't the people who I thought, I'm going to become this person when I have a child. And I felt very hesitant about that. And I also felt like there's a lot of negativity around parenting. A lot of people say, oh yeah, my kids are all this, and all this negativity about, yeah, the lifestyle of being a parent. And I thought, well, if people are so down about this, why would I want to do this? And I think that not necessarily a new thought, but while I was in Korea, I did a lot of research about what does it really mean to learn? Like, how does the human brain really learn? Or how as humans do we learn things? And there's a lot of kind of eye-opening moments that, you know, as kids, my kids haven't been to school yet. They're almost 4 years old and 1 year old. And they've learned a lot of stuff. They've learned everything that they know from us, from, you know, the people around them, and that we are naturally inclined to learn, and that we have a natural drive to learn. We might not all have a natural drive to learn the same things, and that's great, because I shouldn't be a doctor. Someone who has a natural inclination for that should be a doctor. So there's, we all have something innate within us that helps us to learn. But also in that kind of research, I found some parenting techniques that I thought were really mind-opening to me. Maybe it's not so shocking to other people, but in the world of parenting, there's a lot of authoritarian ideas that the parent is always right. This is my rule. It does not bend. And there's a lot of friction that happens in those situations. And when kids ask why, well, why does this need to happen? The answer is always, because I'm your parent, because I say so. There's not really a digging deep into, well, why is that a rule? Why do you need to wear shoes to walk in our grass, on our lawn? Like this kind of tension that maybe is a little unnecessary. And that's a lot of the parenting that I had seen, that like, I don't need to be this kind of person who's always saying no to things that I felt like were not necessary, that that's just the role that a parent needs to play. That's what I previously thought. And then I also had seen parents who were on the opposite side of the spectrum, this permissive style of parenting, where instead of the parent always winning, which is the authoritarian, the child is always winning. So you're always saying yes, no matter what they want. Oh, yes, sure, just do it. That's fine. And then we could say that the parent gets walked on. So there's no mutual respect, where you are respecting their needs and they're learning to respect your needs. Because in my opinion, the goal of being a parent, of raising children, is to help them become well-rounded, respectful adults who can function in the world. And to do that, you can't get walked on and they can't always get walked on. You need to each be able to stand up for yourself. I think that that's a really important thing, to have boundaries, to have practiced those boundaries in your relationships. So when I kind of stumbled upon this middle ground of parenting, where you can learn child psychology, what is your child capable of? What are they not capable of? And allowing them to have freedom while also respecting yourself and having boundaries that, you know, you can say, no, this is not this makes me uncomfortable. This is not something that I want. And giving lots of reasons and having to really dig deep in yourself to think, why can't I allow this? What is the real reason behind this? Is it just I feel uncomfortable? Is it actually socially unacceptable? Is it dangerous? Trying to really dig deep in that, because if you ever have kids, you know, they always ask why, why a million times a day. And it really makes you have to come up with those reasons of, well, why is this? Is this a legitimate thing that I'm asking them to do? And if so, great. It's a great opportunity to explain that. Oh, here's why we do this, or here's why we can't do this. And it's helping teach those like logic skills, also a big challenge as a parent. But when I kind of stumbled upon that I don't need to always say no, I don't need to always say yes, I can be me, I can respect my child, respect where they are at in their psychology, and also be respected at the same time and have this mutual relationship, it felt very freeing. Like, oh, this is a new relationship. It's not just shaping a child to get rid of all their bad parts or the opposite of that. It felt very almost exciting that I can get to know this new human who is separate from me, try not to take things too personally. And I felt like this whole mindset of peaceful parenting, or respectful parenting, it's often called, seemed to open a lot of doors for me. If anyone's interested, there's a really good book called How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and How to Listen So Kids Will Talk. and that really kind of sets a lot of groundwork for this type of parent-child relationship. I hope that that will be helpful to others. It was very helpful to me.
I definitely am going to check that out if I ever have kids.
Yeah, even just being around kids, it's nice to kind of have that mindset of, oh yeah, like they are real humans. They're small. They don't know as much as we do, but they are real humans, and treating them with that type of respect, at least for me, was a big mind-opening moment as a teacher and being around kids and kind of having that authoritarian situation where you're the teacher, they're the child, they have to do what you say, but trying to be respectful of them too. That was really useful in my life. So now I have two kids.
Long story short, right? It's like such a huge paradigm shift. And I really love that, because it kind of makes me think of the same, something that maybe some learners out there can relate to. If they've had the opportunity to travel or even just connect with other people from around the world online, is that people coming from other cultures, other religions, other backgrounds, they have a different way of thinking. And so it's kind of like you were saying that, someone's on one side, someone's on the other side, and you have to find that middle ground. And I think for a lot of people, their automatic response in those situations might be judgment. So thinking like, this other person's wrong, or what they're doing is really weird. But it's kind of like you were saying, you know, with the children, like really digging deep and trying to understand, but why do I think that's weird? Like, is that actually wrong? Is that just because, you know, something that my parents told me, or my, I don't know, that I've seen on the news in my country, or whatever the case is. And if you actually become more reflective about that in those situations, that can be like a really good way to actually, I don't know, to be a more enlightened human being in that sense. So I love that you talked about that with parenting, because I actually have never really thought of that. But it's just like children, I think they're really brilliant. They're geniuses. So in a lot of ways, we don't give them enough respect for that.
Yeah. It feels really nice to have not just be kind of grasping at straws as a parent. What do I do in this situation? Oh, my parents did this, I should do this too. But really have this type of model that's been laid out in a lot of like books and ideas, and kind of follow that to navigate the crazy chaotic world of parenting.
So just talking a little bit more about parenting, one of the things that I was kind of curious about beyond this is that kind of in what you're saying, it's like you really have to reflect and think about like what values you want your children to have and everything. And you have to be really careful in how you act around them, because they watch everything, they mimic everything. And I'm just kind of curious, from your experience as a world traveler, as a language learner, and even as an English teacher, has that affected kind of like any of your strategies on parenting or any of these values that you're trying to impart on your children?
Yeah, I think that anyone's life experience is kind of becomes part of who you are. So I don't know if I can separate me without having traveled or me without having learned a language, what I would be like as a parent. I think that that's really become part of me, and that's thus like shaped who I am as a parent. But as a kid, I didn't know much about other cultures or languages, that other things existed. And I know a lot of people grow up like that. I don't think it's the end of the world, but it's exciting to me to be able to share that with my kids, especially my four-year-old, because he understands more now about like, oh yeah, when mommy and daddy lived in Korea, we ate this food. And he's so excited about the different things we ate in different places. And his favorite food is miso soup. So we make miso like once a week. It's not Korean, it's Japanese, but we always talk about someday when we go here, we go to Japan, we're going to eat miso soup every day. And he talks about that all the time. But this type of, yeah, just realizing that people can eat things different than us. I think he thinks it's better than us, but miso soup is the best for him. But yeah, kind of just introducing ideas about our own personal travel experiences, and that you can be excited about getting out of your comfort zone. I think that can be, yeah, really helpful and, you know, challenging. Hopefully at some point we'll be able to do that with him in this world. But it'd be nice to be able to spend some time abroad and just kind of immersing in a different way of life as a kid, not being too like shocked about that, but just that being a normal thing, that people live differently, and that's a fact of life.
Hey there, Real Lifer. Just a quick break from this episode to share a big announcement with you about the recent launch of the brand new Real Life English app, where Ollie, Andrea, and I, your Real Life Fluency coaches, will guide you beyond the classroom to live, learn, and literally speak English in the real world, which is to understand natives, speak with anyone, and connect to the world. So, how do we accomplish that with our app? To start with, you can listen to the Real Life English podcast, even this very episode, with digital transcripts so that you can follow along and develop your listening fluency, plus check dozens of definitions of all the most difficult vocab, idioms, phrasal verbs, slang, and much more that you won't find anywhere else or in any other podcast. And how would you like to develop real-life speaking confidence at the touch of a button by speaking with other learners while making friends across cultures? Sounds like a dream, right? Well, now with the Real Life app, it will be a dream come true. Download the app to listen to our podcast with transcripts and definitions whenever and wherever you want, and speak with people from all around the world. What are you waiting for? Join our global community today by clicking the link in the description of this podcast or going to www.reallifeglobal.com/app or search for the Real Life English app in the Google Play or Apple App Store today. And let us guide you beyond the classroom to live and learn and speak English in the real world. Aw, yeah. So is there anything that you feel like that your parents did when you were growing up that you believe like your parents didn't do? Because you were mentioning that you've maybe tried to learn other ways, you know, of parenting beyond just, you know, having to parent the same way your parents did. But yeah, I'm curious if there's anything like that that you think was really unique. I could just give you an example that like when I was around the time that I was like a teenager, became a teenager, both of my parents had their own businesses. My dad was a lawyer with his own practice, and my mom, she got into network marketing. So from a pretty young age, I knew that I didn't want to have a boss. And, that's something that, you know, I didn't know how I was going to do it or anything, but kind of coming out of college, and I just, you know, found something and it ended up becoming a business and everything. And I don't answer to anyone but myself. So I'm just curious if there's anything like that that you found that was really unique that your parents instilled in you.
My parents were a little more traditional than we are. I think my kids are going to grow up and think, wait, people leave the house to go to work? Mom and dad just go to this office bedroom and do some work. We often ask, what do you think that mommy and daddy do for work? What do? And he says, you write things on the computer. You make a video. I'm like, okay, that's pretty close. it seems like about it. But I think for my parents, something that they instilled in me, yeah, maybe just encouraging that always trying new stuff because I feel like maybe like you mentioned at the beginning, I'm always dipping my toes in lots of different things and being curious about flying or being curious about always trying to find scheming ways to make a job as a kid, always trying to like send out flyers for babysitting or walking dogs. I always had all these ideas and they seem to encourage that. Yeah, sure. Give it a try. See what happens. I remember one time my parents said, I asked them, I want to make some money. What's some kind of chore around the house that I can do? And they said, I don't know, find something like come up with something. So I came up with the brilliant idea of being paid per hour. So not per job. I wanted to be paid per hour for cleaning the blinds. Though I'm not sure if this is like a universal international thing, but it's something that covers the windows and there's little strips that you can turn. I have some over here. You can turn a little stick and it opens the blinds or closes the blinds so that you can look out the window. But there's maybe like over 100 little strips per window. So I said, look how dusty these are. And I showed them, I tried to like mark it to them a little, look how dusty they are. We're breathing this. Can you believe this? You need to pay me per hour to clean off every single blind. And in the end, I don't know how much I actually ended up making from that, but I thought, I got them this time. I'm going to make so much money doing this. And yeah, I think always just trying to come up with clever ways to make a little job. Maybe I've always been kind of entrepreneurial in that way, scheming a little bit, but yeah, they were encouraging of that and went with it usually.
I can tell that must have pushed you in that direction to some sense. And how did you actually find like people around you reacted when I know that you went to Korea and you came back and that's kind of when Speak English with Vanessa really happened because you just knew that you wanted to do something, right? You didn't want to go back to teaching in a traditional school or anything like that. And what did you find that like your parents or your husband, your family's or friends' reactions was to you saying like, I'm going to do an online business or instead of something maybe that would be more traditional or stable?
Yeah, it's definitely not traditional, definitely not stable, at least at that point at the beginning. I think that the first question a lot of people asked was, how are you going to find students? And I'm the kind of person who hadn't really thought of that. I was like, I don't know. I'll just find them, I guess. I'm just going to do this and they'll come, I guess. So a lot of the how questions I did not ask and other people asked. So I think there is a question that comes later for me. I'm just going to try this idea and then I'll figure it out as I go. But a lot of people were maybe not negative, but just questioning. Oh, okay. Well, we had some savings from Korea, so it's not like we were destitute or, living on a friend's couch for a couple months. Actually, we were living on people's couches for a couple months, but that was intentionally through couch surfing. We did this. Have you ever done couch surfing before?
I did, yeah, for quite a bit of time. Yeah.
When we moved back to the U.S., we weren't sure which city we wanted to live in, so we chose a couple places that seemed to kind of resonate with what lifestyle we wanted, and we couch surfed with people in those cities for a couple weeks, just doing a little tour of the East Coast, and that's how we found where we live now.
That's a great idea. Yeah.
Yeah, it was really great. But I think that initially there's kind of some surprise, and I think when you haven't done that, like you haven't started your own business, there's a lot of unknowns, or like you just don't either think it could work, or seeing it start from the ground up might seem a little bit harried. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just, trying to make some social media posts, especially at the beginning. It felt like, I don't know where this is going, or just to sit in my backyard and film a video on my phone. It felt very unorganized, and a traditional job is quite organized. You know what your tasks are, you know what's going to lead to success. But seeing that kind of grasping for straws, I'm going to try this today. I don't know, I'm going to try this. I think a lot of people question, okay, let's see how this goes. But I don't know, I'm not really the kind of person to be concerned, maybe. Well, I am concerned in some way about what people around me think, but it's not going to stop me if I feel really excited or passionate about something. gonna maybe be a little stubborn. Maybe that's the right word. stubborn, bullish, just keep going and until it crashes and burns or until it succeeds.
Yeah, I think that's super important is that you don't give up or you don't listen too much at the beginning to what people, the doubts of people around you and stuff. If you have in your mind that you want to try it out, you want to try to make it work, then it's like you have to, I think, have that bullishness, as you said. And something you just had said there that you were, you know, you started out, you were in the backyard with like filming with your smartphone and everything. I also started, I think, filming with a, you know, an old smartphone. I think that's how a lot of us YouTubers are. So I'd be kind of curious. A lot of people probably see you nowadays and they see like, you know, 3 million subscribers. They think that it's probably always just been easy for you to make the lessons, that you're just this gifted teacher and you know, digital marketer and everything. Can you tell us a little bit more what it was like for you at that time when you were starting out and if there were any other big challenges that you were facing at that time?
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's definitely a sense of what am I doing? Like every day, just wondering, what do I do today? What's going to help me to make this a business? Because I had no experience with online business, didn't know anything about marketing funnels or downloads or any of this type of, especially the business side of things. That was really a big learning curve. Maybe I've said that a lot. Lots of things in life are a learning curve. But yeah, I think that side of
the title of this podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, everything new that you do, there's a learning curve to it. Learning English, it's going to take some time to get your groove, to figure out what's going on. I think at the beginning, especially with a business, I didn't know that YouTube was something that I would focus on a lot. I didn't know that making like pre-filmed video courses was something that was going to be the future of the business. I was doing, I was focusing more on Skype lessons and one-on-one students. And I think something that really helped me was for the first year, I taught one-on-one Skype lessons for another organization, kind of similar to iTalki. It's called Cafe Talk. And you can set your prices, you can teach whatever lessons you want, but they do the marketing. They bring in the students and then the students could choose you. And I think through that experience, I realized that my students were really happy with my lessons. It got really good reviews and I felt like the experience was generally pretty positive. I felt like if the students are happy, then what I'm doing as a teacher is good. Always can be improved, but good enough. And what I need to improve is the marketing side. So learning more about the business side of it, not just the teaching side, because I think a lot of teachers who want to teach online have that passion for teaching and that light bulb moment and helping students, but then realizing that there's this whole business side of it can be also quite daunting. So it kind of helped me to realize that if I can get the students to find me, then I hope they will be happy because my current students are happy, but I just need my personal students to be able to find me. So that helped me to kind of focus on YouTube, kind of analyze what's working and just realizing my strengths and my weaknesses, not good at analyzing things, not good at statistics and all of that type of thing. So yeah, realizing what works and what doesn't is a good starting point for really anything, the different methods. But there's a lot of uncertainty at the beginning and, you know, still some uncertainty too, but starting off, it's always a little bit more rocky for sure.
Definitely. Something that kind of strikes me is it seems like through many of these different periods in your life, even from when you were young, you were talking about like the blinds, you know, and starting out with your, you know, with Speak English with Vanessa, with just an old smartphone in the backyard, that you were very resourceful. And I think that that's a really important lesson for people is kind of like starting with what you have. So I think a lot of learners out there, something I hear a lot, it's a lot of people come from places or backgrounds that they just don't have a lot of money. And so they say, you know, I can't afford your course or I can't, you know, afford a teacher. But I think if you're resourceful, then it's kind of like you can always find a way. You can create your own sort of course experience by watching a lot of different videos on YouTube, or, you know, you can be really resourceful about going out there and finding ways to meet other learners and practicing together. So I think that that's just like a quality that will in general always help you to be successful if you're resourceful and maybe, like you said before, bullish enough.
Yeah. I think that's a really good point that for English learners, even if you do purchase a course, most courses are not the be-all and end-all of everything, it's good to supplement. Find a way to be able to watch Netflix in English, even if you have to use a VPN or stream something. Finding a way to be able to access the information that you need in our internet day and age, that's become a lot easier. I know it's not easier for every part of the world, but it's becoming easier and easier. So yeah, using what's available. I think that's something that maybe a little tangent, but it's something that's very fulfilling to me in this job, is knowing that because not everybody can afford my courses or your courses or paying for English, I can still give them something very valuable and very useful for free on YouTube. And I think that fulfills that teacher part of me that says, oh, it's so nice to give and to help. And yes, my courses are giving and helping as well, but that giving and helping everyone feels very good. I think that kind of makes me, fulfills a little part of my heart that I'm able to do that. And yes, YouTube can be a career in and of itself, but it's nice mm-hmm. that other people, that anybody can access that. Pretty much anybody can access that. So that feels nice to be able to give.
Yeah, I think when you open your eyes to it, there's just been this huge democratization of, well, I think learning in general. I mean, we've talked a lot about learning, but learning English is definitely no exception. That if you are resourceful enough, if you research a lot, and in general, if you dedicate the time to it, you make it a priority, there's just so much that you can pick up, and so many great teachers out there. So, kind of speaking of your course, I know that, like, one of the things that you offer there is, I believe, at least you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that you have actually like kind of a speaking club within that, or speaking partners, right? And I believe through that you're connecting learners in your course to other people, like, who are also learning in it. So I'm kind of curious, like, what's your opinion, or what have you observed in general with that of, you know, learners learning with other learners? Because I think most learners have in their head, like, I want to speak with a native. How do I meet natives and everything? How do I meet an American or a Brit or whatever's the case?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a benefit to meeting with someone who speaks English as their native language. I think a lot of that benefit too is for your personal, as the learner, your like ego of like, oh, I did it. I talked with an American. Like, you feel good about yourself, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that is like the best option because mm-hmm. I found that for my students, in my course, the Fearless Fluency Club, a lot of students are part of our private Facebook group. And I don't actually have a very organized system for, all right, here's your level, here's your time zone, meet up together. I don't have something like that. We have a system where people join the Facebook group from the course, they introduce themselves, share some information, and people below that comment, hey, I'm in this time zone, let's meet up. And really, it's very student-led. And I think in that way, the people who feel that determination, I'm going to do this, they make it happen. So there's individuals who meet up together, but there's also a couple students. This blows me away every day. There's a couple students who have just taken it upon themselves to host weekly, sometimes two or three times a week, group meetups completely of their own volition. It's amazing to me. And they say, okay, every Saturday, like, for example, one of my wonderful students, Alex, he just had his 4-year anniversary of every Saturday hosting a meetup with people in the course. It is shocking and amazing to me. And that group of people has become, you know, his friends from all around the world. And every Saturday they meet up, and he, for him, he has like a topic that he just thinks of, like, oh, this week someone asked me to help them with their lawn. Let's talk about your yard or gardening or nature, some kind of topic related to life. But then other people in the course have created meetups where they ask questions based on the lesson material. I give a bunch of questions based on like the material we're learning, and they have a more focused or like organized learning style meetup. So there's a lot of different options for students mm-hmm. who want to make it happen and to feel accepted by other students too. And from talking with the students who participate in these, it seems like the fear at the beginning of speaking is very high. Like, oh, I'm like, I can't believe I'm about to just talk with somebody I don't even know on the internet. I'm speaking in English. There's a lot of multiple fears there on the internet. Someone I don't know, another language. what are we going to talk about? Just all of those types of things. I don't like to see myself in the video. Everything is piled up. But then when they speak together, you just get each other. You understand each other because both of you are coming from that same place. Both of you are learning English. Both of you have overcome or are trying to overcome that hesitation and fear of speaking with someone else. So I think really being on an equal playing field, if we can use that expression, with somebody else can help you to take great leaps in your English learning. I found this for myself as well. In France, a lot of my friends were other nannies or other au pairs, but they were from non-English speaking countries. In fact, some of them could actually speak English really well, but I never knew it because we always spoke in French. They were German or Austrian or Swedish. And when we were speaking together, because we were all French learners, we could understand like 80% most of what they were saying. And there's an occasional new word that would come in. But if I were speaking with a French native speaker, I probably would have only understood 10%. It would have been very overwhelming. I probably would have stopped doing that. So having somebody who understands me, and I can actually understand them, but we understand each other's situation of being a language learner, I think that that can be extremely motivating and helpful in getting rid of that fear of speaking, that initial fear. So at least that seems to be the case for a lot of my students who have spoken with each other. And I think it's also an economical way to do that because you might need to pay a lot for a native English speaker teacher or just any professional teacher. You're going to need to pay a lot. But to speak with someone else who is also learning and is both people are benefiting from the situation, then that can be a really great way to learn for a cheaper price, possibly even free. But just to be able to speak together is a great starting point. Okay, I think I talked for long enough about that, but I feel very excited about that because it's definitely true. I've experienced that myself. Speaking with another language learner can help you a lot. So don't dismiss it as an idea. It's definitely a good way to go.
Yeah, I think it's exactly as you said, it definitely like lowers the bar for people. It makes it a little bit, it gets rid of some of those kind of points of resistance that you might have, you know, I'm not going to do it because I don't know what we'll talk about, or I'm not going to do it because this person's going to like really judge my accent or whatever. And I think that on the other hand, there's a added benefit to it that it's a lot more like a real life because most people using your English and stuff, at least maybe that comes from a European perspective, but a lot of people nowadays have work online. And so if you are in a company that's international, it's much more likely that you'll be speaking with people from Brazil and Germany and France and Russia than it is that you're only going to be speaking with Americans or only with Brits and stuff. So it's very important that you understand natives. But I think that you can be more flexible if you have kind of, if your goal is to only speak with natives, then, you know, you might want to try it out because it can be a lot simpler. It can help to lower some of that fear. And like you were saying, in your experience in France and stuff too, you have that empathy factor that you're both learners, you're both going through the same challenges and everything. So that person knows how you feel. And you speak with an American, a lot of Americans, we're not language learners and stuff. And so you might not have that same empathy from that person.
Yeah. Yeah. If I can just give one tip about this type of idea is that, like you mentioned, a lot of people work internationally. I have a Japanese student who works with a lot of people from India and a lot of people from Spain, I think. His company is quite international, but just two specific countries. But he says, as a Japanese speaker, he has trouble understanding Spanish speakers' English or Indian speakers' English. So those specific two accents are very valuable to him in his job. He needs to understand those people when they speak English. So something that I recommended to him and might be useful for some other English learners who need to use English with like a Brazilian coworker and they gotta understand him is to go on YouTube and search for somebody from that language, somebody from a Spanish-speaking country who is speaking English, and get used to the way that that person is speaking. They might not be a teacher. It might just be somebody making a video from Spain, and they're talking about, they're walking around Barcelona, talking about their day, but you're getting used to hearing that cadence and that rhythm and the way that they're speaking, so that when you're in a more stressful situation, like at work, and your, you know, Spanish coworker is speaking to you in English, you're not too shocked. You're kind of ready for that style of speaking. So using YouTube as a resource for hearing multiple accents in English, because you're right, we encounter that everywhere and can't just understand an American accent, but always that people speak.
I used to have a teacher in high school who would call this like practice like we play. So because like every time we had a test, he would like a mock test, he would set it up, you know, like the final test and everything. So it's like we would have that same experience, all of the same emotions and kind of, you know, having to be against time and all of these things that you would face in that. So I think setting up these experiences for you before you have the really, really important thing where maybe you're going to be having an important business meeting, you don't want that to be like your first experience listening to an English speaker in Spain or in Germany or whatever is the case. So I think doing something like that, coming back to the resourcefulness, kind of finding different ways that you can listen to those accents, if you know that's going to be important for that job, then that's going to help you to shine a lot more in that moment and to avoid probably a lot of stress because you've done the practice.
Yeah, practice is very helpful.
So, Vanessa, I want to be respectful of your time. I have maybe just a couple rapid-fire questions to finish up, and then we'll play a quick game before wrapping up the show for today. So one of the things I'm wondering is, what is something that you find that you're usually really curious about that most people are not? So just to give you an example for myself, I notice something, no matter who I'm with, like if I hear a group of people that are sitting next to us in a restaurant or I'm walking on the street and I hear other people speaking another language or even just like speaking in a language that I understand with an accent, I'm like, I'll tell like whoever I'm with, like, where do you think those people are from? I'm always like really curious to know like where are people coming from, what is that accent or what is that language and stuff, and I'll try to like guess, but like most times the people I'm with, they just like, they don't care at all. So do you have anything like that that maybe is like something you are really curious about, but other people maybe they're like, who cares?
Yes, I'm not sure how much I should go into this, but I agree with you. Whenever I hear other people speaking another language, I'm always like, follow them in the grocery store a little bit, like, what are they saying? Especially after we came back from Korea, every time I heard Korean in the small city that I live in, it's a little bit surprising. So I like follow, oh, what are they saying? But I think something maybe a little strange that I feel quite excited about that other people generally seem to not care about is comparing our lives to the Middle Ages. So the Middle Ages is like any time from 1100 to like 1400, 1500, a time when most people were farmers, most people were peasants, most people had no access to raising their quality of life. And especially when I'm thinking about Europe, when I think about my ancestors. So I think at least once a day, sometimes multiple times a day, I think, oh, wow, I'm drinking this tea. This tea comes from India, but it's really a British tea. And it came to me in the US. This is amazing. What did people drink in the Middle Ages? Were they just drinking herbs from around them? Or just thinking about how did they get hot water? Did they have to start a fire and do this? And all of those processes that we take for granted, I think my mind goes on a lot of rabbit trails. And sometimes my husband says this is like my test for a new friend. If I mention something with them, like with kids, you're often Googling things like, why do they have this red spot on their arm? Or why is my kid crying in the middle of the night? We like look up stuff a lot. So if I'm with a parent and we're talking about something like that, like, oh, what did people do in the Middle Ages when their kid was crying in the middle of the night and they lived in one room with 15 people? Did their kid just cry? Did they walk around? And if my new friend is like, I don't know. And like, maybe they're not a good friend. It's just a joke. But my husband says this is like my friend test because I seem to always bring that up. I feel like it provides a lot of perspective on our life. Like, wow, we are living in a completely different world than what people were living in even 200 years ago, but certainly much further back in how people dealt with daily life tasks. So yeah, there's a lot to think about there, possibly.
That's absolutely amazing. That's like, that's something I think about as well. I don't think like on a daily basis, but it's definitely something that like occurs to me from time to time. I think I use that a lot, like as like a kind of a gratitude thing, you know, just like running water anytime I need it, anytime I need to wash my hands, like, you know, having running water in your toilet. These are all things that, like, we hugely tend to take for granted, that you, like, a hot shower, all these things. It's like, just imagine if you had to go out, like, for your morning shower, and you had to go fetch a pail from the river and, like, pour that over you, or like, sit in a tub with, like, cold water and scrub yourself down. It's just, life is pretty good when you start to think about that.
Yeah. I heard someone say once that, like, Louis XIV, so the king of France, Louis XIV had less, he never had a flushing toilet. He never had, could never just turn on the water and there would be water, or turn on the electricity and there was a light. That he had the best that there possibly was at that time. And yet we, as normal people, most people have those types of resources. One thing that I often think about is, like, health and how there's a really interesting book called Outliers. I don't know if you've read that, Malcolm. I think it's Malcolm Gladwell. And he talks about how the maternal and infant mortality rate has become so much better even in the last 20 years. So less children are dying from preventable causes and how they give an example, I think it's in this book, give an example of one of the queens of England. She had the best health resources at that time, and yet she had 13 children. 5 survived over the age of 5, and then 2 survived to be 30 or 40 years old. So this is just unbelievable to us. Like, if somebody dies in our normal daily lives nowadays, it's a huge tragedy. It's very sad, especially a child. But for them, the toughness that they had to have for daily life, to just face daily life, whether that's death, whether that's getting water, they had to be so much tougher. And yet we're the same DNA, the same humans. Crazy. It blows my mind every day.
Absolutely true. I think that all these things are, like, really good ways to just be more grateful for everything that you have. And it makes you think, just like, what's going to be the thing in, what were we saying, like 1100, 1400? So I don't know, you know, in another 600 years, in 2600, what's going to be the thing that people are looking back like, I can't believe that they lived without this. What would life have been like?
Yeah. Who knows?
It makes me really curious now. So you mentioned a few books already. I believe that you're quite an avid reader, that you really enjoy reading and learning, as we've talked about a lot. So is there, when your students ask you, or learners in your community ask you, like, Vanessa, is there, like, a really great book that I should read? It's like not a grammar book, but actually, like, a book that you've actually read from cover to cover. Is there one that you tend to recommend?
I would say, usually, because I like so many books, I created an Amazon has this option where you can create, like, a storefront. And it's, I mean, I think I get like 10 cents if somebody buys a book from that list. It's not like a business option, but it's just a place to have all of the book options. I have almost like a storefront or a playlist of beginner books, of intermediate books, of nonfiction books. And it's like the top 20 that I recommend to students. I have a couple videos about those, explaining those books as well. But if you've never read a book in English, I recommend reading something that's meant for, like, upper elementary. It's not too childish, but it's not too complex with lots of descriptions. So a good example of that might be The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. Have you ever read this book?
I started it. I never finished that one, though, but I have heard good things.
Okay, well, maybe it's not a good option. It's about, like, an autistic kid is the one who's telling the story, but there's a couple pictures. The way that he describes things is, I think, easy to grasp, but there's not too many complex words. Or a book like Holes. This is meant for, like, upper elementary age kids. But if you want to look at a whole list of that, below every YouTube video that I have, there's an Amazon link to all of those books. So you can just see, like, all of the top beginner books, because that can be a really good way to boost your confidence too. Like, I finished a whole book in English and I liked it. That's great. That can be a good way to learn, but also kind of feel good about your English skills.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that reading too, it's like the best way to pick up vocabulary and to, like, really, for me, like, I found that when I read, I just, my grammar naturally gets better when I speak, because it's like you kind of are seeing how everything's supposed to be laid out, and somehow, I mean, our brains are pretty amazing, somehow that gets absorbed. So we can definitely grab that link from you or from one of your videos and stick that into the show notes. So if anyone is wanting to go get some book inspiration from you, then they can go do that. And maybe even start with the one you mentioned with the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime. That's the title, right?
Yes. If I can give a little quick tip about reading is I would say for English learners, don't stop at every single word you don't know. If there's a word that you don't know that you see a lot. So for example, I was reading the Chronicles of Narnia in French and they kept saying one word, épée. And I'm like, what is épée? I don't know. They keep saying it. And then I looked it up and it's sword. So they were talking about swords. So if a word comes up again, look it up, but don't feel too scared. If you see 20, 30 new words on a page, try to get through like 10 pages and get the general idea of the story. If you need to look up some stuff, that's fine. But I think looking up every new word will really kind of be a downer. Yeah. It won't help that motivation. So just try to push through a bit to get the context, and then you'll really get immersed in the book and you'll be able to skim over words that you don't know, or you'll be able to guess based on the context. So yeah, don't feel too stressed if there's a lot of new words. Yeah, just try to get the context first.
Totally. The first book I ever read in German, I did exactly what you said that you're not supposed to do. And I was like, I got like 2 pages in and I was like, this is so boring. Like I don't even remember what has happened in these 2 pages. And I think once I started just like being like, okay, I'm just going to go for it. And I would like underline words. And then like, you know, later I'd finish the chapter. I knew everything that happened from like the context and everything. Then I'd go like look up. But I think just like looking up every word, it's like you're going to kill yourself. So
yeah, yeah. Or if it's a book you've already read in your native language, like Harry Potter, yeah. Super. That's like a movie. You know, if you already watched a movie in your native language, watch it in English. It makes it so much easier and you can just, yeah, immerse yourself in it a little bit better.
That's a great challenge, actually, is like if you've never read a book, just pick up something you've already read in your own language and read it in English in this case. Great. So I want to jump into a game before we wrap up today's show. So we're going to do a word association. So I have a list of some words and basically I'm just going to say it and you're going to say the first thing that comes to mind. And if maybe we can have like a small conversation if any of them are particularly interesting. But I think that this is a great way, if any of you out there want to get your creative juices flowing, as we would say, then you can actually go. I think there's tons of lists of these online and it can be like a good way to just start getting things rolling in your noggin, in your mind. So the first word, memories.
Childhood?
Oh, that's a good one. Childhood memories, yeah. That's great because it's like a collocation as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're childhood memories, something that you feel nostalgic about.
Exactly. Traveling?
First thing that came to my mind for some reason was flying. In the U.S., you have to fly to travel anywhere.
That's very true. But I think, too, it's like if you're someone who's lived abroad, if you've like, you know, you went to live in France and you went to live in Korea, maybe like that first time getting on that international flight can be quite exciting. So,
yeah, I remember the first time I bought my my plane ticket to go to France, mm-hmm. I felt like maybe this was a little too overly ambitious, but I felt like when I bought that ticket, I thought, this is it. I'm fluent in French right now. I got it. I got my ticket. This is the ticket. It felt so exciting. So that kind of image of flying. Yeah, I guess that's linked with traveling, at least traveling internationally.
Most definitely. Maybe it's also just like that desire right now to like get on a plane and go somewhere far away since we've been taken away from us.
Someday soon, I hope.
Motherhood.
For some reason, the first thing that came to my mind was cuddles.
Oh, there you go. At least it's positive.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, my son's not very cuddly. He likes to just go, go, go. He says, I don't like kisses because they're too wet. So when I get those moments of him sitting on my lap and coloring or sitting on my lap and reading a book or just under a little blanket together at night when he's about to go to bed, that's a really precious, precious moment, very special and rare.
I'm glad it's that and it's not like screaming or chaos or like something along those lines, you know?
Well, it might be waking up in the middle of the night too, but
you know. Sleep deprivation, yeah. All right, work.
I think the first thing that comes to my mind, especially with work, is the computer. Because I associate work more maybe with some, not negativity, but like the hard part, the like less rewarding part. And I think looking at the computer is like something I don't enjoy about work, because I feel like work kind of has that heavy sense to it. But if I thought about like teaching or English or students, this type of thing, it has a more positive connotation to me. But yeah, the computer is like work.
I totally know how you feel. I think for me, like nowadays, a real vacation is one where I don't take my computer with me, where it's like it's left at home because there's nothing needs to be done.
Yeah, unplug.
Exactly. All right. Well, I'll do a last one before we wrap up. So this is a pretty good one. Passion.
Oh, I was thinking to say excitement. This is a little vague, but I feel like, have you ever seen the Enneagram model? It's like Enneagram personalities, and you can kind of, you can take a test about which personality you have, or you can just read the descriptions and guess what you are. But one of them is the enthusiast. If you can guess, that's me. someone who feels like really passionate about something and then just goes all out, like Middle Ages, I'm going to learn everything about it. Flying, I'm going to learn everything about it. And maybe that passion is short-lived. Maybe it's a long-term thing, but that excitement kind of goes along with passion to me. Excited about something, hopefully learning English for our students.
Well, I think too, that comes across so much for anyone that's watched your videos. And if they haven't, I think that that's definitely one of the things I've always admired about you as a teacher is that ability to get people excited about learning English. I think it's just like that energy that you bring to it and everything, it's contagious. And I think that's so important because you want people to come to the classroom and to feel invigorated, not to feel like the classic image of being there doing conjugations of I am, you are, and all that. So I think that that passion, excitement is definitely a great quality.
Thank you. Thank you. I think that is a good goal. Be excited about what students are learning. You're excited about it. Hopefully that is contagious and they get excited about it too.
Exactly. So Vanessa, I want to thank you so much for all of your time. Just to wrap up, first of all, do you have any asks for our audience?
Oh, I think that I would like to ask students to, going back to our first topic today, to set aside your phone for a moment and go for a walk. Maybe 15 minutes. Maybe if you are in a lockdown situation and you can't walk, walk around your house. And just, yeah, spend a moment thinking about the things that you are excited about in life. Maybe that's English. Maybe that's your kids. Maybe that's the bird chirping outside. But yeah, just take a moment, unplug, and yeah, think about that passion that you have for something, even if it's just for that moment. That's what I'm going to do today. So that's the thing for myself too.
That's fantastic. I absolutely love that. I definitely want to go do that myself right now, get away from the technology for a little bit. But this has been absolutely lovely. Where can people find out more about you if they don't already follow you on YouTube? Where can they find that? And if they want to learn anything else, where should they look?
Yeah, you can search for Speak English with Vanessa on YouTube, or you can look at speakenglishwithvanessa.com. That's another thing often people say that don't know my business. They say, oh, what's the business name? And I say, Speak English with Vanessa. And every time, without a fail, people go, oh, well, that's easy. There's no mystery about the name. So Speak English with Vanessa, pretty clear.
That's perfect. So thanks so much again, Vanessa, and everything that we've talked about, any of the books that you've mentioned, links and everything will be over on the show notes. And I look forward to seeing you on the next show.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
Thanks so much for joining me today. I hope you enjoyed the interview. You can find all the mentioned links and resources from this show on the show notes at reallifeglobal.com. It is also linked in the description of this episode. If English fluency is important to you, then remember to check out our Real Life app, where you can practice listening to native speech and speak with other learners from around the world while also discovering new cultures. You will find that linked in the description, or just search for Real Life English in the Apple App Store or Google Play Store. For now, remember that no matter what divides us, that which unites us is far greater. See you on the next show.